Paul Dennis. We'll talk a little bit about the current analytical framework. I neglected to mention that Paul is a partner at Deckert. He was the principal drafter of the 1992 merger guidelines, and the relevance of that may be clear as he speaks. And Paul is the developer of DAMIT, which really analyzes how long it takes for the agencies to clear large, complicated merger transactions.
Thank you, Bilal. Thank you for the opportunity to be part of this conference. Tough act to follow, Susan. Fascinating presentation. Mine will be much more prosaic, focusing on the legal framework. But Susan has set it up well in giving you some context for the type of problems that we've devised these legal frameworks to handle. I will focus on the acquisition context. I'll stay away from the issues of predation or vertical. It'll be difficult enough in the time available to get through just talking about the analytical frameworks we have in place for analyzing mergers that involve nascent potential competition issues. If you're a believer in fate, you might actually think I was fated to do this presentation. In the fall of 1982, I was in Ann Arbor, halfway through a course of study in law and economics. And despite having just finished a lucrative summer clerkship at a big law firm, I needed money. So I needed a part-time job. And we had a visiting professor in that fall, a guy named Joe Broadley, and he was going to teach my antitrust class. So I figured he must be trying to write some papers. Maybe he needs a research assistant. I should go see him about a job. So I went to see him, and I didn't know much about Joe Broadley at the time. But if I had done even a modicum of research, I would have learned that he had written the seminal article on what was called the potential competition doctrine. It was an 89-page, 300-some-odd footnote tome in the Yale Law Journal, cumbersome title of Potential Competition Mergers, a Structural Synthesis. It was a mouthful. But as fate would have it, he was working on another article. He had been asked to contribute to a California law symposium on mergers under the then brand new 1982 merger guidelines. And his topic was, not surprisingly, potential competition mergers. I'm not sure that he really needed a research assistant to help him with that, but he hired me. What was supposed to be a job turned into a paid tutorial for which I was the principal beneficiary. With my short-term cash flow problem in check, I started thinking maybe I need another job next summer. So I proudly put on my resume that I was the research assistant for the distinguished Professor Joe Broadley working on this important article on potential competition mergers, and signed up for a bunch of interviews with law firms that were doing what I thought was important antitrust work. And one of the firms I had targeted, Skadden, sent two interviewers to campus. And one was a tax lawyer, and one was an antitrust lawyer. And somehow, by luck or design, I ended up on the list with the antitrust guy. Turned out that was Bill Pelster, who had just tried the Grand Union case, one of the FTC's most important potential competition decisions. By the time I interviewed with Bill, I knew a little bit about the potential competition doctrine, not a great deal. It was a good thing I did, because he spent the whole interview telling war stories about the case and drilling me on various aspects of the doctrine. So Joe Broadley saved me there. Bill never really interviewed me, but he managed to get me a job anyways. But I had the benefit of working with Bill and a number of other extraordinary colleagues, including a guy who was just about my age, well, I think all of you know, it's Joe Simons, now our FTC chairman, a great group of people. So why do I tell you these stories? Well, I tell them in part because I thought I could get away with it before Bilal would give me the hook, and I could honor some people who I think were important in my career. But I tell you these stories because they illustrate what I think is a central point that we need to focus on this afternoon in these hearings. And that's that these concepts of nascent and potential competition really are pervasive in U.S. antitrust merger law and merger enforcement practice. It's something well embedded in in our legal framework. In the panels that are going to follow, we, you know, we'll debate the efficacy of some of those frameworks. But I don't think there's any debating that these concepts are well entrenched into our antitrust thinking. I'll set the stage for the panel discussion by outlining really just at a high level what some of these concepts are. But first, before delving into that, I'll touch on some definitional issues so that we can hopefully make the discussion a little bit more tractable. Then after reviewing the framework, I'll offer a couple thoughts on ways in which the framework might be filled out. And the panel discussion will allow us to dig into those issues and others in more detail. So the terminology in this area is, to say, not the greatest. Some of the terminology is not well-defined. Some of it is well-defined, but it's defined in ways that most users do not find to be intuitive at all. Nascent competition doesn't really have a formal legal definition. The word itself implies some degree of competition that's present, but maybe not yet fully realized. In common usage, the term nascent competition is sometimes used to refer to competition that we've yet to see. I think that's incorrect, and I concede I've fallen into that usage at times myself. So my suggestion for this afternoon is we try to focus on nascent competition being limited to competition that's presently being felt, but not yet fully realized. Used in this sense, the acquisition of a nascent competitor by one of its rivals would be seen as extinguishing not only current competition between those firms, but also either extinguishing or perhaps amplifying the prospect for greater competition in the future. The term potential competition, by contrast, really is well defined in the law. The courts have spent a considerable amount of time parsing what's called the potential competition doctrine. And they developed a bifurcated concept of potential competition, distinguishing between perceived potential competition on the one hand and actual potential competition on the other hand. The essence of these two types of competition is not immediately obvious from their names, so we'll spend just a minute focusing on, you know, what the courts have left us in this area. Perceived potential competition is focused on the present competitive effect that's thought to result from incumbents' perceptions about the prospects for future entry. The acquisition of a perceived potential entrant, therefore, is thought to lead to a reduction in current competition, as that constraint that's being imposed by the threat of future entry is eliminated. So the potential for the acquisition to increase competition through the realization of synergies or otherwise is really not part of the perceived potential competition doctrine, but as we'll discuss over the course of the afternoon, remains part of the standard antitrust merger analysis. Actual potential competition, by contrast, is focused on the future competitive effect that's thought to result from future entry. Don't ask me why they call it actual, then. The acquisition of an actual potential entrant doesn't change current competition in any way, but it's seen as a matter of concern because it eliminates the increase in future competition that's expected to result from that future entry. As with the perceived potential competition, the prospect of increased competition from the merger is not part of the doctrine, but it remains part of the analysis in practice and part of our discussion. So as I said, these definitions are not intuitive to most people. They probably aren't intuitive to you. They never were to me. But that's what the courts have given us, and my suggestion is that we use that as our guide for this afternoon so that we don't find ourselves talking past each other. You know, as I noted at the outset, these issues really are pervasive throughout the analysis. The impact of nascent and potential competition really begins at the very first steps of merger analysis when we determine the base price to which we're going to apply the so-called SNP, the small but significant non-transitory increase in price that's applied in the hypothetical monopolist paradigm. Continues through the identification of market participants, the assignment of market shares, and measurement of market concentration. In defining the competitive effect of concern, that's where we're most profoundly influenced by notions of nascent potential competition. It's here where antitrust merger analysis takes us into issues like the potential competition doctrine. But it was dissatisfaction with that potential competition doctrine that led to the development of other alternatives to the traditional market definition that were thought of perhaps being better ways of incorporating concepts of nascent potential competition into the analysis. We can talk about how well we've done with those. Those are things like innovation markets, or technology markets, or R&D markets. Entry analysis, of course, is inherently about potential competition, as is efficiency analysis. And efficiency analysis doesn't even make the page here, reflecting the short shrift it usually gets in merger analysis, but it is most assuredly part of the consideration of the impact of nascent potential competition. The treatment of efficiencies and other forms of dynamic, what I call dynamic response, such as rapid entry or committed entry, raises a point of practical application that I believe warrants further discussion this afternoon. While guidelines and analytical frameworks generally purport to be burden-free and try to avoid giving you relative weights of evidence, there has been a decided drift in how we look at these issues. And it's been a drift in the direction of what I regard as somewhat asymmetric treatment of potential competition, nascent competition. And that drift was reflected, first in the 2006 DOJ and FTC commentary on the merger guidelines, and later in the agency's revision of the 2010 guidelines. I think the agencies are properly focused on protecting nascent and potential competition. It is something that warrants protection. Panel discussion will explore the appropriate scope of that protection, but it is certainly warranted in some circumstances. Where there's been a decided reluctance has been in recognizing, or at least fully crediting, nascent and potential competition as market forces that can be relied upon to ensure continued competitive performance in markets that are affected by mergers among incumbent firms. Firms that are well-established in the market and that are not either nascent or potential competitors. So as the agencies sharpen their focus on nascent potential competition, my suggestion is that the burdens of proof and evidentiary standards that are imposed on that analysis be imposed in a symmetric way so that we're equally likely to consider and recognize, credit a nascent or potential competitor as a market participant as we are to look at it as a market force of interest in traditional horizontal merger analysis. So having introduced the primary ways in which the issues of nascent potential competition analysis affect our merger analysis, let me go into each of them in a little bit more detail and then go into how the framework might be filled out a bit. So in implementing the hypothetical monopolist paradigm, the agencies typically apply the SNP to the current market price. But nascent and potential competition in a market may mean that future prices are going to be quite different than current market prices. And it may mean that we can reliably predict those prices to be at a lower level. The guidelines recognize this effect and suggest that in those circumstances that anticipated future prices be used for applying the SNP. So all other things equal, using these lower anticipated future prices will lead to definition of more narrow markets, the identification of fewer market participants, and the recognition of fewer other entrants. It's just one way in which nascent and potential competition is slipping into the analysis that most people may not be paying attention to. In the identification of market participants, separate and apart from treatment of the benchmark price, the guidelines are recognizing that market participants are not limited to firms that are currently producing and selling the relevant product. All right? The guidelines explicitly recognize that new entrants, firms that are committed to entering but you haven't done so, will be counted as market participants. All right? They will also include so-called rapid entrants, the firms that are expected to be likely to respond to non-competitive performance by supply responses that don't involve the expenditure of significant sunk costs. Those firms will also be counted as market participants. So the guidelines is already looking at a number of these nascent potential competitors and thinking about ways to include them in the analysis. In some sense, the guidelines have converted horizontal merger analysis so that it is subsuming some aspects of what we call potential competition analysis. Both these new entrants and these rapid entrants look and feel a lot like so-called actual potential entrants, which is why I suggest that horizontal merger analysis has subsumed a great deal of what was previously thought of as a separate doctrine. It's become an issue, an objective test, really, of the timing, the likelihood, and the sunk costs associated with their entry. So even after these market participants have been identified, nascent potential competition issues come into play in how we assign market shares. The shares of the incumbent firms may be discounted based on reliable predictions of the impact of nascent potential competition. And because share is a zero-sum game, then some portion of the share has to be attributed to those nascent potential competitors. The use of projected shares necessarily affects the measurement of market concentration because market concentration is itself a function of share. But even if there's not some quantitative adjustment in shares, and therefore some quantitative adjustment in concentration, the guidelines recognize that there is a significant qualitative difference in the analysis when an incumbent proposes to acquire a potential entrant. In practice, we see a comparable adjustment made in analyzing the merger of an incumbent firm with a nascent competitor, particularly when we're looking at coordinated effects analysis. The nascent competitor is likely to be regarded as a so-called maverick. So defining the competitive effect of concern, as I suggested earlier, really is the hotbed for the inclusion of nascent potential competition issues into our analysis. This is felt in horizontal merger analysis, in potential competition analysis, and in vertical analysis. In horizontal analysis, most often we talk about price effects. The guidelines go beyond price effects because nascent potential competitors may affect product quality, may affect product variety, and may affect the level of innovation in the relevant market. I've grouped all these together as output effects because output really is the best way of measuring what's going on, particularly when you have price and quantity moving simultaneously. Guidelines have also explicitly focused on innovation effects as a competitive effect of concern. Yeah, these innovation effects are increasingly the focus of the agencies in practice. What innovation effects are of concern? There's a concern about the reduced incentive to continue innovations that may be started by the acquired firm, be a reduced incentive to initiate development of new products. But there's also, potentially an increased incentive and ability to innovate that might derive from the combination of complementary capabilities between the incumbent firm and the nascent or potential entrant. The guidelines recognize this as well and take it into account in efficiencies analysis. Here again, this asymmetry issue that I mentioned earlier comes into play with the agency practice seeming to reflect an expectation that reduced innovation incentives are the more likely outcome resulting from mergers rather than an increase in innovation. The source of this asymmetry is perplexing to me because despite all the focus on innovation, we do not have a generally applicable theory of innovation that links innovation to mergers or links innovation to market structure. Economists have written countless models that attempt to predict innovation. And within the confines of the assumptions of those models, they work. But determining which of these countless models to apply in a given real-world situation, where the real-world situation doesn't conform to the assumption of any of the models precisely, remains a dark art at best. The potential competition doctrine is perhaps the most focused embodiment of these issues in merger analysis in the U.S. Over the years, the courts and the commission have imposed significant but appropriate evidentiary requirements on making out a case under the potential competition doctrine. I think that those requirements reflect, you know, considerable uncertainty we all have over how reliably we can look forward and predict what's going to happen in the future. While the Supreme Court's accepted the notion that perceived potential competition states a claim under Section 7, they twice reserved on this issue when thinking about the actual potential competition doctrine. I think that's simply the inherent conservatism of the court, addressing only the issues they absolutely have to address and not dealing with other issues that they can duck. Section 7, after all, is focused on whether the acquisition is likely substantially to lessen competition. But left unstated in the statute is lessen competition relative to what? In practice, we've all filled in the answer there, and it's lessen competition relative to what would happen absent the acquisition. So this counterfactual is inherently forward-looking. It requires us to consider what competition would be in the future, both with and without the acquisition. So just as General Dynamics teaches that we have to consider factors that can reliably be said to predict, you know, diminished future competitive significance for incumbents, we need to apply the same sort of thinking to nascent and potential competition and ask where we can reliably predict what the future effects of nascent and potential competitors might be. Again, this symmetry problem comes into play and how, you know, our going in biases affect how we look at that issue on each side. You know, I'm running well past my time here, but we'll try to wrap this up. Just perceived potential competition doctrine, three primary elements here: market structure, uniqueness, and effect, right? The market has to be structured in such a way that entry likely would have a pro-competitive effect. Normally, we look at concentration as being the indicator there. Uniqueness is a second requirement. This acquired company, the potential entrant, has to be one of few comparable potential entrants. And finally, in effect, the prospect of entry by this firm has to actually have an effect that alters incumbent behavior in some pro-competitive sort of way. If the actual potential competition shares the first two elements with the perceived potential competition doctrine, market structure and uniqueness, but adds two others, right? The actual potential entrant actually has to have a plan, right? There has to be a subjective intent to enter, and objectively, you know, the trier of fact has to conclude that they have the capacity to enter. Finally, that entry has to be likely. You know, the commission's BAT decision is probably one of the more focused opinions on this point. And on the likelihood requirement, the commission applied an elevated standard of proof. There had to be clear proof that entry was in fact likely. So because those elements of proof were difficult for plaintiffs, there arose a number of alternative doctrines to try to get around the potential competition doctrine, yet incorporate concepts of nascent potential competition into the analysis. You know, they are themselves innovations. And these are the concepts of innovation markets, technology markets, and R&D markets. Given where we are on time, we'll leave the details of these to discussion on the panels. So filling out the framework, where do we need to go with this? We have a well-developed framework. It's been applied for years, and we'll talk about how well it's been applied. But there certainly are points that could be filled out a bit. The empirical foundation is probably the first and most obvious. To use the term that Chairman Simons has used, you know, we have limited empirically grounded economic analysis of the effects of nascent potential competition. And this is certainly an area of research, to the extent we have professors in the room. Encourage your best and brightest graduate students to pursue this. Part of getting there may be by doing more in the way of retrospective analysis. The commission has certainly pioneered these efforts in the past. We have a much greater need for retrospective analysis of our predictive tools in this area than in other areas. This is not a real damning criticism of this area of the law. I mean, it's true throughout what we do in merger analysis. We have a number of tools that we use that we haven't quite tested out yet. I mean, think of upward pricing pressure, where we spend, you know, a considerable amount of time without having any strong evidentiary foundation for knowing that the upward pricing pressure theory is actually predictive of what's going to happen in mergers. We even have some reasonably good empirical evidence that it's not predictive. So this is an area where actual nascent potential competition, you know, shares a weakness with horizontal merger analysis. And, you know, a little more in the way of retrospective analysis and a testing of our predictive tools is in order. Probability. We're talking about two things that are inherently probabilistic events, you know, a nascent competitor becoming, you know, more competitive in the future, a potential entrant coming into a market in the future. These things are not black and white. They may happen, they may not. We don't have a generally accepted threshold of what the probability of success must be before we need to protect this nascent potential competition, or before we recognize it as a market force in looking at horizontal merger analysis. I think we need one. And there actually may be a bit of an implicit one that the commission has already adopted. For those of you who are familiar with DAMIT, Bilal mentioned earlier, the Deckert Antitrust Merger Investigation Timing Tracker, you know that our firm, we have a habit of, you know, digging into what the agency's actually doing to try to infer what's going on behind the curtain of non-public investigations. So with the help of my colleague, Costa Medvedosky, we took a look at the commission's enforcement practice in pharmaceutical mergers, see whether that might tell us a little something about, you know, what is the probability of success that you have before you're really going to count these nascent potential competitors. And you know, we can talk later about the details of this, but our preliminary view suggested that the answer might be something north of 60%. And we get there by looking at the commission's enforcement practice involving pipeline-branded pharmaceutical products. But certainly, when you look at the pharmaceutical area, and, you know, I see Mike Moisiev's here, and he knows this better than anybody, the commission has considerable experience, has a well-developed reputation for thoughtful enforcement in this area, and does not go chasing after low probability events. Last point here is the temporal dimension of the analysis. You know, we don't have clear guidance on the time frame. If you remember back to the 92 guidelines, we used to talk about supply responses occurring within a year, in response to a SNP that lasted a year. We talked about entry occurring within 2 years from initial planning to significant market impact. But in the 2010 guidelines, we moved away from bright line tests towards something that was far more nebulous. So we talked about whether rapid entrance would occur in the near future. And we talked about whether committed entry would be rapid enough, whatever rapid enough might happen to mean. So we've sort of lost track of, you know, a firm temporal dimension for anchoring our consideration of nascent potential competition. That's something that I think will need to be revisited in order to give us a little more clarity about how these doctrines are going to be applied when it comes to platform acquisitions and other related concepts. So just to sum up, you know, I think we have an analytical framework in the U.S. that, you know, provides fairly rich consideration of nascent potential competition issues. How well it's considered is something that I hope you'll join us in discussing in the panel discussions to find.